Thank you guys again for having me and allowing me to go through this book, you know, with a whole new attitude and outlook. And I love every time I go through this book, it's, you know, I hope for a new experience. And I love this book. I never thought I would say that about any book. But I do. I truly love this book. And I just before we get started, I mean, obviously, I'm Carrie. I am an alcoholic. My home group is the three legacy. My home group is the New Horizons group. And I have a sobriety date of March 25th, 2010. And before we get started, I want to first thank David for keeping me on track, like all the time. That must be a hard, that's a tall order, but he does so well with that. So thank you. This is the fourth week out of 13 weeks. And we are on page 21. And secondly, I'm so glad to see Michaela here today, because in this meeting yesterday, there was something said about the word insanity. And I'm hoping we get to step two today. I'm not planning on it, but hopefully, because I identified with so much I heard in yesterday's meeting. And part of my whole step two is around getting over that word insanity. And the big book allows me to do that with such amazing grace. And so I'm excited to get there. And then before I quit cross-talking, I will say that Kara, who is a sponsee of mine, we just, every Friday we meet, and we go through, you know, we're starting to go through this book, and we meet at 1:30 my time. Right now it's 3 o'clock. So we go through from 1:30 to 2:30, and we meet for an hour every Friday. And her and I just got done with the paragraph that we left off on. And so I had to call her, and I'm like, oh my God, like, we're starting as soon as David told me where we were, because he has to keep track. I called her and I'm like, you got to log back on, because we're starting up just where we just left off. So that's kind of cool. It's a God thing. So anyway, Kara's with us today also. so I'm gonna go ahead and, we left off on a qualifying paragraph, right? The last thing that we read is on page 21, and it was about the real alcoholic. It's talking about what is a moderate drinker? What is a heavy drinker? Oh, okay. Now what's the real alcoholic? Well, the real alcoholic may or may not ever become a continuous hard drinker. They may not ever become late stage alcoholic. They may not ever become addicted to alcohol, but at some phase of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink, right? So we found that out. That paragraph, that small little paragraph, closes all loopholes of doubt in any alcoholic's mind, right? It closes the loopholes, so we can't talk our way out of being an alcoholic. Well, now there's a few paragraphs. Well, actually just one really super big paragraph that's like over a page, that talks about kind of all the different things, all the different types of alcoholics, and talks about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I'm not going to read all through it, but you know, it talks about the type of alcoholic I was. I definitely was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I was one way when I was drinking and one way when I was sober. And it talks about a whole bunch of different things that some of us relate to and some of us don't. Some of us will relate to some of it. Some of us won't. It's an identity paragraph, like where, you know, you find yourself in it. You might not find yourself in all of it, but it's a big paragraph. And one of the spots that I do want to point out in that big paragraph, is about 11 lines up from the bottom of the page. You might already have your notes from page 7 in Bill's story. But it's a highlight that I have that says he is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor. Now, just a heads up. And I'm going to, so what Michaela was saying yesterday about the insanity, I'll tell you, out of all of the 12 steps combined, step 2 took me longer in like time than all of the other steps combined, because I could not swallow that insanity pill. I couldn't do it. And it's because it's like, I've seen 12 monkeys I know what insanity looks like. You know, I know that people who are insane get thrown into a padded room wearing a straitjacket and they chew on their sleeves and they drool. And those things weren't my, you know, some of us end up in insane asylums, but I'm not one who did. And I'm like, I'm not insane. And thank God for the literature. Thank God for how clear the literature is. It's not talking about insanity. It's talking about alcoholic insanity. And there's such a huge difference, such a huge difference. You know, in Bill's story, and I'm just going to point this out at the end of Bill's story, when he tells his doctor, when he tells Silkworth, oh my God, what's happened to me? Like, I think I've been restored. And I think that there's no more, where was that? So he tells, I don't know where it is now, but he tells his doctor, oh, here it is on page 14. So he tells Silkworth, oh my God, like something happened. I felt lifted up as though the great wind of a mountaintop blew right through me. Like, God comes to most people gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Like, what happened to me? And Silkworth is, of course, telling him, I don't know, but you better keep it because anything is better than what you had, right? And then Silkworth, and then there's something that differentiates alcoholic insanity from plain old insanity that the outside world talks about, and that I heard talked about in a meeting yesterday, that has nothing to do with alcoholic insanity that this book talks about. It says, for a moment I was alarmed and I called my friend, the doctor, to see if I were still sane. Now, if he was insane, he wouldn't be calling the doctor to ask if he were still sane. That is the sanity that we see on the movies. That is not what this book talks about. This book talks about, page 9, alcoholic insanity. 4 lines down from the top of the page, it's highlighted. Alcoholic insanity. This book talks about, I was aghast. So there it was. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot, not a crackpot, an alcoholic crackpot. Like, throughout this whole book, it talks about alcoholic insanity. And on page 7 of Bill's story, it says, it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. Well, that's what it just said on page 21, where we left off. It says, he's often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor. That's alcoholic insanity. And I could swallow that pill because, yes, I've never paid a bill on late in my life. You know, no, I still have my license. No, I'm not committed. I'm not on medication. But every time I say I'm not going to drink and I swear it off forever, I end up doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results where alcohol is concerned. And that is alcoholic insanity. And I could swallow that pill because it was my experience 100%. And so, you know, and going forward in the book, I'll just take you to real quick to page to. Okay, so that was page 21. Let's go to page 26, get forward a little bit, right? About 12 lines up from the bottom of the page. Again, he seemed to be quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems. Yet he had no control whatsoever over alcohol, alcoholic insanity, not plain insanity, alcoholic insanity. And then again on page 38, well, it's actually all over. It's like in the first 44 pages it's just littered with it. 38, about 11 lines up from the bottom of the page. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol had been involved, we've been strangely insane. And that is the definition of alcoholic insanity. It's not just plain insanity, it's alcoholic insanity. And I suffered from that. And I've never suffered from insanity like what we see on TV. A lot of people do who come into AA. That's that's fine, but that has nothing to do with alcoholism. So that really helped me to swallow that word, you know. So now, okay, so we're going to start on the, in the middle of page 22. It says, why does he behave like this? So it goes through all the different types of things that we do when we're drinking. And it says, why does he behave like this? 100 of experiences show him that one drink means another debacle with its intense suffering and humiliation. Then why does he take that one drink? What has become the common sense and willpower that, again, because he's still sane, he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? I mean, literally the whole first 44 pages is about this exact thing. It's about nothing else. So perhaps there will never be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently than normal people. Well, why does the alcoholic react differently than normal people? What is the definition? Does anybody remember what the definition of an allergy is? We looked it up in the very beginning in the doctor's opinion. It's an abnormal reaction to a food or substance. So if I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol, then yes, that means I react different where alcohol is concerned than other people. That's what an abnormal reaction is. That's why we call them normies. No, we're not saying that they're normal in every respect, like, you know, a sane person. We're saying that they are normal in the effect that alcohol has upon them. And that's why we call them normies. I mean, a lot of people call them normies. I don't, but I've heard that in meetings, and it's because they're normal drinkers. They can drink with impunity. So we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from a drink as he may do. So, okay, here's another bodily and mentally down at the bottom of the page. I don't know if those of you are highlighting the two part here. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol whatsoever into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense. Two parts, right? Which make it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. These observations would be academic and pointless, though, if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. This is where the chapter "There Is a Solution" flips from the physical aspect to the mental aspect, from neck down to neck up. To the craving, to the obsession, right? Neck down is physical. Neck down is craving. Neck up is mental. It's obsession. So it's saying here that, you know, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took that first drink. So if I'm allergic to a strawberry, like the analogy I used last week, and I just swore off strawberries forever, and I just stayed away from strawberries, and I just said, I can't have a strawberry shake. I need a chocolate shake because I'm allergic to strawberries. Then these observations would be academic and pointless, right? So if I just didn't pick up a drink again after I knew that I'm allergic to it, then it wouldn't matter. It would be one part disease. So thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body, because my mind is what has the alcoholic insanity that tells me that it's okay to pick up that drink, even though I know that I'm allergic. That's where the main problem is, because if I didn't have that problem, then I wouldn't have any problem because I'd just stay away from the drink and it'd be a one-step process. I admit I'm powerless over alcohol and that I can't drink it. My life becomes unmanageable. So I just don't do it. You know, I don't have to do a 12-step program for not drinking lighter fluid or anything, any other kind of poison to me, right? I just don't do it. But that's why the real problem centers in the mind, is because when we take a drink, the insanity of alcohol, the insanity of the alcoholic insanity, it's not the stupid stuff we do when we're drunk. Everybody does stupid stuff when they're drunk. The non-alcoholic, if you put as much alcohol into the non-alcoholic as I put into myself, they're going to be doing just as much stupid stuff as me. The insanity is what precedes the first drink. The alcoholic insanity is why I take that first drink in the first place, knowing that I have never had much success in the past with it. So, if you ask him why he started on that last bender, chances are he will often offer you one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of a man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Now, this is kind of cool. Once in a while, he may tell the truth, the alcoholic. And the truth, strange to say, is that he usually has no more idea why he took that first drink than you do. Some drinkers have excuses which with they're satisfied part of the time, but in their heart of hearts, they really don't know why they do it. Once this malady has real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. But they often suspect that they're down for the count. I had a newcomer I was working with about 3 years ago, and the room that we meet in the church is fairly small at my home group. It holds 50 people, but there's always 60, even though the fire code is 50. And so people are standing up in the back of the room and stuff. So if somebody's in there and they're drunk, you're gonna smell it. It's a sardine can. And I was working with this new woman who, chronic newcomer, right? You know the kind. And she showed up to get her 30-day coin, and she was drunk, and she didn't think that anybody noticed. And I knew that she was gonna, after, she came and she sat by me. And after a second, I don't remember what I said, is just how you doing or whatever. And she tried to play it off like, oh, good, it's my 30 day. And I realized, oh no, she's like not gonna admit that she had been drinking. I don't wanna let her make a, fool out of herself, blah, blah, blah. So I took her outside before we did the coins in the, in the beginning of the meeting. And I took her outside onto the ramp. And I said, look, I'm not trying to start anything, but I'm trying to save you some embarrassment. I know that you've been drinking, and if I know that you've been drinking, others are probably going to be able to tell too. And if you're planning on taking a 30 day, I'm not going to be giving it to you. And she just started crying, and she said, I suppose that you can't work with me now, right? And she was crying. And she said, you're then we don't get to work together. Now I'm gonna have to find a new sponsor. And I said, oh no, this is good news. You haven't done, I use the SH word. If you could stay sober on your own accord, then I would probably not be able to work with you because you're probably not a real alcoholic. I said, just the fact that you showed up to get a 30-day coin drunk, qualified. Yeah, we can work together. Like that means you're an alcoholic. Like this is good news. If you could stay sober and doing as little as you have done, then yeah, absolutely. I probably couldn't work with you anymore. But because you got drunk, that just qualifies you as an alcoholic. And that's what this is saying. Once in a while, they might know why they took a first drink. She doesn't know why she took a first drink. She's trying to come up with excuses. And I said, I don't need to hear an excuse. Anything you tell me is going to be a lie anyway. You're an alcoholic. You didn't drink because of this or that. You drank because you're an alcoholic. That's why we drink. You're an alcoholic who's untreated, who hasn't done any work, and of course you're going to drink. Like that's why we have AA. If you didn't, then we wouldn't need AA. So how true is this? Few realize that in a vague way, their family and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal. I have that word highlighted, remember, because we are abnormal drinkers. We have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. That's what an allergy is. But everybody hopefully awaits the day where the sufferer will rouse himself from the lethargy and assert his power of will, which alcoholics have good willpower. I'll tell you what, I have seen alcoholics go to any extreme to get them some whiskey. They show some definite willpower. It isn't about willpower. The tragic truth is that if the man be a real alcoholic, and it's using that term again at the bottom of the page 23, if the man be a real alcoholic, the happy day may not arrive. He's lost control. At a certain point in every drinking, at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into the state of the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. Now, when I read these next two paragraphs, think about how many times you've heard people in meetings say, you know, put the plug in the jug. Just don't drink and go to meetings. Go to lots of meetings and don't drink in between. Remember your last drink. Think that drink through. How many times have we heard this stuff, right? I mean, I could go on. Unfortunately, I could probably go on for an hour with those examples. Well, let's see what the book says. Let's see what the literature says. Well, the literature says, in italics, I may add, that the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable to, at certain times, to bring into the consciousness with sufficient force the memory and suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against that first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the minds to deter us. Think that drink through? No, if these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure, not just a failure, a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, oh, it won't burn me this time. Here's how, right? And we go through that whole list of stuff on page 31 about, you know, oh, we'll just drink on weekends and we'll just, you know, switch from scotch to brandy, or we'll go on a trip or not take a trip and all that stuff, right? Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often has some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way and after the third or fourth pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, for God's sakes, how did I get started again? Only to have that thought supplanted with, well, I'll stop with the sixth drink, or what's the use anyhow? That's why we need AA, you guys. That's why we need a spiritual experience. That's why we need steps 2 through 12. If it was a one-step program and knowledge self-knowledge availed me a program of recovery, that would be wonderful. But that's not the case. When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. These stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics through history, but for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop, but cannot. Good news. We're halfway through the chapter and here's the good news. Ready? There is a solution. Woo! There is. I mean, because that first half of the chapter seems pretty hopeless, right? Like the first half of the chapter, the moral of the story is you're screwed, right? So the second half of the chapter, well, good, there's a solution. All right, let's get to it. Well, almost none of us like the searching, the leveling of the pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires, not suggests. Just wanted to point that out. Sorry. Oh, man, here's where I want you guys to get a dictionary. And here's where 40% of you guys are going to get a resentment. But it's coming from the book and not from Carrie, okay? The process requires for its successful consummation. What? What does consummation mean? Oh my God, does it mean completion? Sure does. But I thought that there's no completion to the program. That's not what the book says. Ha! I guess, you know, if you want to be recovering for the rest of your life, that's great. You know, more power to you. More power to you. I'm so grateful that I have had a successful consummation, full stop with a period, because for me, I'm a recovered alcoholic, meaning I don't think about drinking anymore. I'm too busy thinking about others to think about myself and drinking. I'm too busy working a program of action to start thinking about why I want to take a drink. The last time I had a drinking dream, I was 18 months sober, and that's not of myself. That's because of steps 2 through 12. And because I had a successful consummation, not a successful beginning, consummation. Look that word up. Consummation basically is, and if you look, because now I'll backtrack a little bit just to ease your guys' resentment a little. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of the pride, the confession of shortcomings. So what it's talking about is the process between 4 and 9. Okay, that's the recovery process. No, we never finish steps 10, 11, and 12. That's where we get to grow along spiritual lines. That's where we get to practice these principles in all of our affairs. That's where I never have an end date. But the process of 4 through 9, the process of recovering from alcoholism, it happens. It happens if you take 4 through 9 earnestly. And, you know, it's not a 9-step program, so I get to stay in steps 10, 11, and 12 for the rest of my life. But the process, it has a consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of the life that we have been living. When we were approached by those who, what? Oh, the problem has been solved. Whoa, another big bucket of hope. There was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven and have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, of which we had not even dreamed. Oh, yeah. Let me see some of the, there we go. Biddy got it. Those emojis are what I want to see, the party ones. So the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. Asterisk means that we get to go to the spiritual experience in the back of the book, right? So let's go to Appendix 2. I love Appendix 2. It's my second favorite appendix after Appendix 1. So Appendix 2 in the back of the book is titled Spiritual Experience. I'm not going to tell you what page it's on because it's going to be on a different page for you than it probably is on me. I have a study edition. So the term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book. Upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself in many different forms. Yes, it's true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that the personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. Now, what does that mean? That means that in the first edition, many of the stories in the back of the book were white light experiences. They were burning bush experiences, right? And so they're saying the first edition, because this appendix was put in when the second edition was written. So they're saying, yeah, the first edition, we kind of seemed like you had to have this immediate God consciousness, like God came through the bedroom window and, you know, blessed you and dubbed you sober. But happily for everyone, that is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Thank goodness, because that wasn't, you know, I was of the educational variety myself. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, the friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months, whoa, did they just give a timeline for the 12 steps? I don't know. I'm not saying that. I'm just going to read it again. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most empathetically, we wish to say that in any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, not honesty, because there's no such thing as how in Alcoholics Anonymous. For those of you who are taking notes, that comes from the basic text of Narcotics Anonymous, and it's in none of our literature. Our literature says who. Willingness, always first in every piece of AA literature. Honesty and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but they are indispensable. There is a principle which is bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep us, to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. I love that part. And it also reminds me of the prayer that Amber said in the beginning of this meeting for to keep an open mind for a new experience. Because a lot of the things, I know that a lot of things that I probably say, you know, you're hearing me say it for the first time, but it's in the book. And so, you know, having an open mind and allowing for room to have a new experience with this literature, it is the essentials of recovery. And I hope that I hope that I never become not teachable. And so long as I have an open mind, and a willingness to have a new attitude and outlook upon this literature, even, and upon what I have always known AA to be compared to what it actually says in the literature, then I can continue to grow in usefulness and effectiveness. And, you know, I pointed out the how, the how that's not in our literature, the how that made it in through the program of Narcotics Anonymous, which I love the program of Narcotics Anonymous. I never have anything bad to say about the program of Narcotics Anonymous. My best friend is 18 years clean in the program of Narcotics Anonymous, not an alcoholic, but she works a damn good program, but it's not AA. In our literature, we have who, and the reason it was explained to me that willingness is always first. And this is the first time of many that I will point out to you when these three words are together in our literature, not just in the big book, but everywhere, willingness is always first. And there's two reasons for that. The first reason that it was pointed out to me is because how am I going to be honest and open-minded without first being willing to be honest, without first becoming willing to be open-minded? Like, willingness is the foundation, right? And it said that in Bill's story too. Upon a complete foundation of willingness, quote unquote. So willingness is, it has to come first before anything else can take place. And the second reason that it was explained to me is because for years, I was trying to figure out how to control my drinking. I was trying to figure out how to fix my life. I was trying to figure out how to do this. And I get to Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys tell me for the first time, no, 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 not how. There is one who has all power, and that one is who? Right? God. Let go and let God. Stop trying to figure out how and turn to who. So getting off that soapbox, going back to page 25. let's see. If you are as serious of alcoholic as we were, we believe that there is no middle of the road solution. We were in a position where our life was becoming impossible, and we had passed into the regions from which there was no return through human aid. We had but two alternatives. One was to blot out to the bitter end, was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could. There's one hand. Wow, that looks attractive. And the other, to accept spiritual help. To an alcoholic in their cups, you know, that could be a tough decision. Looking back, it's not such a tough decision. But I remember when it was. I remember when it was like, oh my gosh, do I go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation? Or do I accept spiritual help and drop the rock and turn it over and let go and let God, right? All right, here's another physical and mental for those of you highlighting right on page 26, right smack dab in the middle of the first paragraph that starts out a certain American businessman, and it says his physical and mental condition. So there's another one. I'm just going to kind of try to skip around so that we can get to step two next week. So he returned to the doctor, which he admired, and asked him point blank, gosh, I can't really skip that paragraph. Dang it. Okay. So a certain American businessman had the ability, good sense, and high character. For years, he floundered from one sanitarium to another. He had consulted the best known American psychiatrists. He had gone to Europe, placing himself under the bed. So this guy, basically what this paragraph is saying is this guy had every means and resource at his disposal, right? And to nothing of his avail. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short period of time. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. Remember, it says some of us, you know, might come up with an excuse once in a while, but really in our heart of hearts, we don't know why we fell. And that's what it's saying here. So he returned to his doctor, whom he admired, and asked him point blank, why could he not recover? Well, he wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? Well, because he had alcoholic insanity. but he begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless, right? He was an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. He could never regain his position in society, and he would have to be placed himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. This was the great physician's opinion. Like, this was a nationally well-known doctor, the best in his field. And he said, sorry, you're hopeless. There's no hope for you. You're going to have to hire a bodyguard or lock yourself up in a sanitarium. Get this. This was Roland Hazard. But this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on earth where other free men can go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Some of our alcoholics readers may think that they can do without spiritual help. Well, let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with his doctor. The doctor said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. And a lot of this is the third time it's saying alcoholic mind or the mind of a chronic alcoholic. You know, another little piece of hope is by the time we get to our 12th step, sanity will have returned, right? The problem will have been removed, right? The 10 step promises will have started to materialize for us. On page 101, second paragraph down, says, yeah, a lot of people say we must avoid, you know, drinking, we must not have it in our homes, blah, blah, blah. We meet these conditions every day. And in fact, an alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. Probably needs to go back to step one. So the alcoholic mind does not, you know, it. There is a solution is basically what I'm saying. So upon hearing this, okay. So he said, doctor, is there no exception? Like, what can I do? And the doctor said, yeah, there's exceptions to such cases as yours that have been appearing since early times. Here's one, once in a while, alcoholics alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are a phenomenon. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of our lives, of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I've been trying to produce such an emotional rearrangement within you. With many individuals, the methods in which I employ are successful, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Now, they're distinguishing an alcoholic of our type, the alcoholic of the hopeless variety, the real alcoholic, right? And so upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he had reflected that, after all, he was a good church member. This is where the book describes the difference between spirituality and religion, right? So after all, he was a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctor telling him, well, his religious convictions were very good. In his case, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience. Here the terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself when he had the extraordinary experience, which, as we have already told you, made him a free man. Oh, this is my favorite part in the chapter. Okay, happy endings, right? Okay, we in turn sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. What seemed at first a flimsy reed had proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, or if you prefer, and I prefer, and that's why I have this highlighted, a design for living that really works. The distinguished American psychologist, William James, in his book, Varieties of Religious Experiences, indicate a multitude of ways in which men have discovered God. We have no desire to convince anyone that there is only one way by which faith can be acquired. If what we've learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living creator with whom we may form a relationship upon and understandable terms as soon as we are willing first and honest, because willingness always comes first, right? In this book, in this program, enough to try. Those having religious affiliations will find here nothing disturbing to their beliefs or ceremonies. There is no friction among us over such matters. Here we go. We think it no concern of ours what religious bodies our members identify themselves with as individuals. This should be an entirely personal affair, which each one of us decide for himself in the light of his own past associations or his present choice. Not all of us join religious bodies, but most of us favor such membership. In the following chapters, there appears an explanation of alcoholism as we understand it. The chapter addressed to the agnostic. Many who once were in this class are now among our members. Surprisingly enough, we find such convictions no great obstacle to a spiritual experience. Further on, clear-cut directions, and I have that highlighted, not in a general way suggestions, but clear-cut directions. And that's just what I need. I mean, in a general way, you know, suggestions never worked for me. I needed clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. These are followed by 42 personal stories. Each individual in the stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view, the way he established a relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea, clear-cut again, I love that, what actually happened in their lives. We hope that no one will consider these self-relieving accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholics, men and women, desperately in need, will see these pages, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be able be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Going into more about alcoholism. I'm going to read this, and you've probably read it a lot, but I'm going to, and you've heard it in meetings a lot. And so what I do with a newcomer, because this is first step, these first two pages, this is the first step in the book. This is the meat and the potatoes in the book. I'm sorry, these first two paragraphs on this page, on page 30. But I tell the new people that I'm working with to highlight certain things. And when they're in meetings on their first step, and I'm just describing to you what, how I work with others, because that is what was asked of me during this workshop, to show you how I take others through this book. And when we get to this part in the book, what I do is I have them highlight certain words. I'm going to tell you what words that those are. And when they're in a meeting and they hear the secretary or the chairperson or whatever you call it in your area say to someone else, hey, will you, I've asked so-and-so to read more about alcoholism, or I've asked so-and-so to read a portion of chapter 3, to pull out that book and to open up and to read along, not out loud, but to read along with whoever's reading it, and focus and give thoughtful contemplation on the words that are highlighted. Because I think that we hear it so many times over and over again that it becomes, we don't hear it anymore. We listen, but we don't hear it. So I'm going to, every time I come to one of those words, I'm going to say it twice. I'm going to say that word twice. And that means I have it highlighted. So if you guys are following along, you can highlight it with me. Okay. Most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from. Nope. I take back everything I just said. That's on. I'm two chapters off. Sorry. That's what I do on chapter 5. Forget it. Okay. So There are some important highlights though. Real alcoholic, that's a good one. No person likes to think he's bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. That was my whole drinking career. Countless vain attempts to prove I could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday he will control and enjoy his drinking at the same time. Because sometimes I was able to control my drinking. I did not enjoy it. And sometimes I was able to enjoy my drinking, but I was out of control. To control and enjoy my drinking at the same time, now that was a tall order, was the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And I have abnormal drinker highlighted. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursued into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were real that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or may presently maybe has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic, says it again, ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by a still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that, here we go, alcoholics of our type, right? Not just the allergic type, or not just the type that have been addicted to alcohol. Alcoholics of our type are in the grips of a progressive illness. Over a considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make, here's another highlight, alcoholics of our kind, because that's all they're talking about here, like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there's no such thing in making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. So despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics, because it continues to over and over again, real alcoholics are not going to believe they're in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to this rule, therefore non-alcoholic. I hate to admit this, but I'm gonna. Before I can finish reading this page, you know, it took me 9 months to get my sobriety date in AA. I would get 3 to 5 days put together and drink, 3 to 5 days and drink, 3 to 5 days and drink. I once got 23 days and woke up in Mexico, but it definitely took me 9 months to get my permanent sobriety date. In that time, you know, I hung out with young people. I was 30, but I was hanging out with the young people in AA crowd. I was going to WIPA conferences and doing all that stuff in that first 9 months. And most of the time I was, when I would get drunk, it would be with other people in AA. there was one time that we used this reading as a drinking game. If you can imagine how sick that is. And every time this reading says drink, drank, or drunk, that meant that we took a drink. If you can imagine how sick that is. Now, this is something I learned in AA. These are the meetings that I was attending. This is who I chose to try to recover with. So I'm going to, you know, use this as in your head, as I'm reading this, try to think of singleness of purpose and try to get around that. You know, imagine that if you're, I don't know, a non-alcoholic heroin addict or a non-alcoholic gambler or a non-alcoholic trying to get sober in AA, this reading is very loud as far as what we're recovering from. So here we go. Ready? Buckle up. If anyone is showing the inability to control his drinking, can do the non-about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heavens knows we have tried this hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we've tried. Drinking, beer only. Limiting the number of drinks. Never drinking alone. Never drinking in the morning. Drinking only at home. Never having it in the house. Never drinking during business hours. Drinking only at parties. Switching from scotch to brandy. Drinking only natural wines. Agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job. Oh my God. Taking a trip. Not taking a trip. Swearing it off forever. With or without a solemn oath. I told you guys about the time that I found my notarized contract with myself that I took to the bank and had the bank lady notarize. Found it when I was 3 years sober in my file cabinet. I must have done it while I was drunk. Taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitments to asylums. We could increase the list at infinitum. We do not like to pronounce any individual alcoholic. I love this part, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step up to the nearest bar room. Try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. If you're successful the first time, try it more than once. I mean, it's not going to hurt if you're not alcoholic, right? It will not take long for you to decide if you are honest with yourself about it. It may be worth a bad case of jitters if you get a full knowledge of your condition. And thank God for the old timers in Alcoholics Anonymous that cared more about my life than my feelings. And they told me things like, here's a 20, little girl, go get yourself a bottom. And I was so pissed that I would drink at them. But guess what? I wouldn't be sitting here today knowing for a fact beyond a shadow of a doubt that I tried everything in my control. And I am truly an alcoholic. And I know that to my innermost self because of those old timers that didn't try to talk me out of a bottom, that didn't try to steal my bottom from me with frothy emotional appeal and tragic stories of their own. They told me, go get a bottom for yourself. And thank God I found one. Though there's no way of proving it, we believe early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. But there's difficulty. The difficulty is that few of us, that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there is yet time. We've heard of a few instances where people who showed definite signs of alcoholism were able to stop for long periods of time because of an overpowering desire to do so. I have one of those stories. I had an overpowering desire to stop because I was getting physically addicted to alcohol when I was 22 years old. I was just drinking every day. I hung out with the partiers. Once I started, when I was 21, you know, I shared with you guys about my experiment of drinking like a normal person, and I had a whole plan of how I was going to do that. I failed miserably. Anyway, once I was in acceptance that, okay, I don't drink like a normal person, I started drinking every day, and I started becoming addicted to alcohol, which again is nothing to do with alcoholism. People can get addicted because they form a habit, right? And I was suffering from alcoholism that bad yet, but I did start getting physically addicted, and it scared me. And so I made a New Year's resolution to stop drinking for a year. And just like it says in this paragraph, though there's no way of proving it, we believe that early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking, but there's the difficulty is that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there's yet time. I had the desire to stop, and I did it. And I didn't have to change my environment. I didn't have to change my people, places, things. It was a New Year's resolution. And I thought, if I could stay sober for a year, then I probably don't have a problem. And the first couple of days was hard because I was a little bit physically addicted, had some, you know, very minute, petite, lightweight DT stuff, right? And then I stayed sober for a year. Now, I could tell you toward the end of the year how many days left. I'll tell you that much. I knew exactly 65 days left, 64 days left. So I don't know if I didn't have the alcoholic mind at that point, but I was able to stop drinking. Now, never again have I ever been addicted to alcohol again. I never got that physical addiction again. I never became a daily drinker again. But alcoholism took me over. And whenever I drank, like that phenomenon of craving got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then that's alcoholism. It has nothing to do with addiction. What I was experiencing when I was 22 was probably physical addiction, dependency on alcohol. But this thing that I have is progressive, and boy, did it progress. And so I always thought, I had it in the back of my mind, wow, well, I quit drinking no problem when I was 22. So I could do that anytime I want, right? Because I did it for a year. And so that's the thinking that I had throughout my entire 20s, is I can quit drinking anytime I want. So when I turned 30 and the plan was to put it down and never drink again, I was shocked when I had a complete inability, when I couldn't, like I had lost the power. I couldn't not drink. And all those years I thought, well, I stopped for a year. So obviously I proved it to myself. We'll get through Fred's. Actually, you know what? We are going into step two. So I think this is good. I think we'll stop here and then we'll do steps two and three next week. I think this is good. We're right on track, guys. Yay! Questions.
All right, Carrie. Awesome. I want to say thank you so, so much. Guys, please send me your questions in the chat. I've got a couple here for you, Carrie. All right. So first question I have is, why did it say that we complete or finish/recover from alcoholism, even though we have to live in 10, 11, and 12 every day?
I mean, I'm just telling you what the book says. If you want my opinion, then I can give you my opinion. But what the book says is we recover by working steps 1 through 9, right? And then we have, and then we've had a successful consummation. So like the analogy I give you with my car, you know, my engine blows up, I take it into the mechanic either replaces it or repairs it, it's good to go, 100% recovered. But I can't just expect to drive my car for the rest of my life without taking it in for oil changes, tire rotations, putting gas in it. I mean, you know, just because I've recovered from the maintenance. So I have to, now that I've recovered, now I get to maintain my and keep in fit spiritual condition. And in order to do that, and thank God, after the 10th step promises, there's a place in the book on page 85 that after it says the problem has been removed, it doesn't exist for us, right? We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. The next paragraph that talks about maintenance, and we're not there yet, so I try to reserve questions for where we are. But the next paragraph says, it talks about the maintenance. And it says that, you know, we're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve, not contingent on our spiritual condition. If it said we had a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition, I would have been drunk Tuesday before last at my business meeting. Like, I was not in fit spiritual condition the Tuesday before last. I will tell you that much. But what it does say is that we have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And maintenance is an action word. So it's contingent on the action that I'm willing to take even when I don't want to. On my self-appraisal that I have to do even when I don't want to look at myself in a true light. My prayer and meditation even when I don't want to. Picking up the phone when it's a sponsee that I've already talked to four times the day, even when I don't want to. That's the type of maintenance, action. It's a program of action, right?
Awesome. Thank you so much, Carrie. That was the best answer. All right, next question. If you're struggling with the spiritual experience and keep relapsing, they have done the steps one or more times, what do you suggest?
Okay, well, first of all, I don't know what doing the steps one or more times means, because for me, you know, I was taken through the 12 steps. And when I get to my 12th step, I tell my sponsor, okay, so now we start on number one. And my sponsor's like, for what? So I can do more work on myself? She's like, no, you've done plenty of that. Now you go work with someone else and let God do his work on you. So I don't know what, you know, if somebody has actually gone through the 12 steps, which means taking someone else through this work, because that's what the 12th step is, or if you're talking about the fact that you just go through 1 through 9, 1 through 9, 1 through 9, 1 through 9. And if you're doing the 1 through 9 dance, then yeah, of course you're going to drink, because my permanent sobriety depends on my constant thought of others and how I may best meet their needs, not how to fix me and work on me and me. Like, I'm my own problem. So this is a selfless program, a less of self program, not a selfish program. So I don't know. I've been in meetings where somebody who had 20, 30 years relapsed, right? And they come back and they're like, oh, you know, I stopped going to meetings and that's my problem. And that's why I relapsed. And I was fine until I stopped going to meetings. And after the meeting, and, you know, maybe one day somebody will prove me, you know, otherwise, but I always make time to ask that person. I said, for my own sobriety, for my own doing the research, how many sponsees did you let down when you drank? Well, I didn't really sponsor. Mm-hmm. Oh, you didn't. Oh, okay.
All right. Thank you, Carrie. Next question. Where do we find who instead of how in the book? What page was it?
Oh, it's all over the book. Well, what we read today.
That's the next question. Okay.
Whenever those three words are together, you'll notice that willingness always comes first in our literature. It's semantics. It really doesn't matter. But we're here to study the book and we're here to study what our literature says. So that's why I pointed it out.
Okay, cool. All right, next one. All right. If the book says he used alcohol and high power sedatives, why is it that we should only speak of alcohol in the rooms?
drugs aren't an outside issue. Drug addiction is an outside issue.
Okay.
Sex isn't an outside issue. Sex addiction is an outside issue. Gambling isn't an outside issue. Gambling addiction is an outside issue. And Bill Wilson did not say that he got addicted to high power sedatives. Bill Wilson said that he was so alcoholic, just like Dr. Bob. You know, when Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson were struggling with their alcoholism, not their drug addiction, they were so bad off that they asked a doctor to give them medicine so that they could come off of the alcoholism. This has very clearly to do with their alcoholism and has nothing to do with a drug addiction. So the doctor gives him, Bill Wilson, you know, a high power sedative to help him with his detox from alcohol. And he was so alcoholic that he took the sedatives and then still drank. Like, that's not a drug addiction, you guys. That's alcoholism. Like at the extreme, you know, and I can see that because I had this sponsee. I picked her up from the hospital for I met her at the hospital. It was on a 12-step call. And the next time I had to take her back to the hospital, the hospital's like, we don't want her anymore. We're done with her. We've seen her 12 times. We're done with her. Here's some drugs. Go give her the drugs. Get her detoxed yourself, but we don't want her anymore. So I had to go, you know, we went to the pharmacy, we got some drugs. I don't know how I feel about this, but, you know, we did it. And I gave her the drugs. They were high powered sedatives that help her to, you know, come off of alcohol. She was physically addicted, right? So she's going through those DTs that she could die, you know? And so the doctor gave her those drugs and she willingly took them, not because she wanted drugs, but because she didn't want to die coming off of alcohol. And so when I left her and I had a couple of sponsees who, you know, they were going over and checking on her every couple of hours or whatever. But when I came back and I checked on her in the morning, she was drunk again. She was taking the high powered sedatives, but I found her drunk the next morning with the high power sedatives and the alcohol. It has nothing to do with drug addiction. Nothing, less than nothing. It has to do with alcoholism.
Thank you, Carrie. Okay, next one. And I believe this is the last question I have. So if you guys want to send me any more, I would appreciate it. All right, next one. Do you ever tell a sponsee that has drugs and not alcohol in their story to just stay in AA because it's stronger than NA? Just say alcohol instead of drugs. Substitute the word alcohol for whatever your symptom.
I mean, it's my personal preference to try to encourage people to work an honest program. But I suppose you could tell them to just lie. For me, honesty works real great. It's the best. But if somebody else wants to build their program on lies, then that's up to them.
So I'm going to add a question kind of on top of that one. What do you tell someone who comes to you and wants to work with you, but then says that alcohol isn't part of their story?
Well, first of all, I say that I can't work with them if they don't drink and if they've never drank, but I am not shy in going to other 12-step fellowships. In fact, I didn't used to like it. It didn't used to be my favorite thing, especially like I had to go to CR a couple of times. And if you know what that is, I mean, just, you know, I've taken women to and men to all sorts of different 12-step fellowships to watch those lights come on and to watch that magic of Me Too happen for them. And now today I love doing it because I love seeing that magic of identification and I love watching them and I don't participate in these other 12-step fellowships. I'm there as a guest and I won't go to a closed meeting. But when I have a new person who has been struggling, trying to find identification in the rooms of AA and just hasn't gotten it. And I find out it's because they're not an alcoholic and we go to where they can identify. And then all of a sudden you see this thing happen. That's so magical that I guess today I almost crave it, you know? I mean, it's almost as good as sitting with another alcoholic across the table and going through this book and watching the lights come on in their eyes and watching that hope occur. and somebody who struggled in the rooms of AA for years and never found identification and continues to relapse because alcohol is not their problem. Mm-hmm. It's almost selfish that I love watching that magic of Me Too happen. And it's beautiful.
This next question, I'm going to ask it because I do have it, but I think that what you just said is going to kind of help that with the whole identification thing. But the question is, why would people want to work with an AA if they need NA or something else? Are the programs a lot different?
The programs aren't much different at all. And in fact, I don't know if I should say this in an AA meeting, but the way my mind works, I mean, I guess I'm not ashamed. I'll just say it. I love the workbook, the NA workbook. And it's because it's so structured. And like I said, I love the clear cut directions in the big book. Like there are even more clear cut directions in the NA workbook. So I don't know. I don't have anything against it either. I do know that they do have some pretty big differences. And so it's hard to work those two programs really together. Because there are some pretty big differences. I don't think one is better than the other. But I think the reason why people end up in AA is because sometimes the outside world doesn't know. You know, we don't know what we don't know until we know it. And I'm not going to blame treatment centers or courts or any of that. Because ultimately it's our responsibility in our CPC committees and our CTF committees and our public information committees to go and talk to these professionals and let them know that we're not the only game in town. And you know, and I've been known to take, in the corrections workbook, you will find a list, a 3-page list of other fellowships in addition to Alcoholics Anonymous that we are to give out to professionals just so they know that we're not the only game in town. But I think a lot of new people whose problem is something other than alcohol, not in addition to alcohol. I want to be real clear. If you have problems in addition to alcohol, come on in. Welcome. You're not alone, because I don't think anybody has been just an alcoholic without having problems in addition to alcohol. If your problems are other than alcohol, and alcohol isn't a problem, then there's a whole bunch of other places that will meet your needs.
Thank you very much. All right, next question on your, so this is to you, do and don't list for sponsees. How do you deal with someone that can't stop drinking? So this is an opinion question.
I don't know how to answer this without sounding arrogant. My experience has been that if you're doing what I ask you to do, you don't drink. If you're doing what the book says to do, you don't drink. If you're not willing to do what the book says to do, then I don't fire you, but the conversation, I've never fired a sponsee, but the conversation starts to look like this. I feel like I'm doing you a disservice because you think you're being sponsored and you're not. And if I'm not a good fit and you can't follow my directions, I think that it's best that you ask someone to sponsor you who you can take direction from, because I don't want to be doing you a disservice. And so, you know, if you are taking direction from me, which I'm just a conduit, all my directions come straight up out of this. This is my big cheat sheet. I don't make anything up. Then for some reason, you just get sober. It's just been my experience.
All right. Thank you, Carrie. All right. This is my final question that I have. It says, so when people in meetings say that they are alcoholic and an addict, is AA treating both alcoholism and addiction?
Okay. Again, I don't offer opinion. alternative, this is a tradition question, not a step question, but I'll, since there's no more questions, I'll answer it. Page 18 of the AA group pamphlet has our primary purpose statement, and it says, and this is the God as he may express himself through the group conscience of the United States and Canada and not Carrie's opinion. The primary purpose of any AA group is to carry the AA message to alcoholics. Alcoholics is in italics. Experience with alcohol is the one thing all AA members have in common. It is misleading to hint or to give the impression that AA solves other problems or knows what to do about drug addiction. So if I am identifying myself with a duality of identification, it implies a duality of purpose in a single purpose fellowship and therefore is not in alignment with our tradition five.
Awesome answer. Thank you so very much. And I really appreciate how you go to the literature to answer your questions. I much appreciate that. But all right, Carrie, I want to thank you so very, very much. I have it. Oh, wait. We got one more. All right. Has AA ever been sued for telling people to go drink as a diagnostic exercise?
So the good news is every group is autonomous. And, you know, my home group is New Horizons. If New Horizons went out and bought somebody a bottle and made them drink it right there in the meeting, which we would never have done and we never will. I'm just using this as an example. AA can't get sued for New Horizons doings. Every group is autonomous. And you know, they could try to sue New Horizons, but good luck because nobody owns it. Mm-hmm.